opioid epidemic pops up in headlines across the country and consumes a lot of attention. But opioids aren't Alaska's only substance-related problem. During community conversations across the state, people also talked about alcohol and other drugs that are hurting their communities. They also spoke about solutions that require input from everyone. Today on Talk of Alaska, we'll discuss the state's new opioid action plan and its comprehensive look at strengthening Alaska's communities.
Talk of Alaska was made possible by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Substance use disorders are complicated. They're influenced by our environments and the people around us. They can be related to past traumas or mental illness, but they can also be prevented and treated. Today, we're talking about the development of the state's new opioid action plan and ways we can work together to reduce substance misuse in the state. My guests today in Anchorage are Andy Jones, director of the Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention, and Elijah Gutierrez with the Alaska National Guard Counter Drug Support Program. And joining us from the KTOO studios in Juneau is Christina Love, who's a specialist with the statewide Coalition Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, but is here as a person in long-term recovery. Thank you all very, very much for being here.
Thank you.
And to all of our listeners, we welcome you to join the conversation. How has substance misuse affected you or your family? What has helped you or your community? Let us know by calling 1-800-478-8255 or here in Anchorage, 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Andy, I'd like to start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about what's in this plan and why it was developed?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. How about we start with why it was developed?
Okay. Why do we need a statewide action plan?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So there is a saying out there that isolation fuels addiction. Community is the cure. And so quite often as a federal agency or a state agency, we come in and in the past we act like we're a superhero, that we're going to save the day. And in reality, that doesn't work. I've been in state government for 12 years now and have learned quite a few lessons. And so we realize that we only know so much about this epidemic, and we know that it's affecting Alaska across the state, but it's affecting communities in different ways. And so that's why we started a process of traveling around the state with really, you know, saying we're going to collect information. We want to listen to the voice. And so I know we only have so much time, but a little story. I was actually tasked under Governor Palin on the Community Climate Change Immediate Actions Group for Kivalina, Shaktulik, and their emergency procedures. And so I was a planner, and I went out to these communities, and I made assumptions and listened kind of, but I created plans that were hundreds of pages long. And the community came back to me and was like, what are you thinking? And an elder from the Norton Sound region said, Andy, listen. The voices of Alaskans will tell you what is needed. And so I remember that. And so we're going through this process, and I said, boy, it's going to take a community. I need to force multiply an army of people, an army of Alaskans. But to do that and to get the buy-in of our communities, we need to go across the state and we need to have a conversation. We need to talk about what's going on in their community. What are the current resources in their community? But what's the gaps? And then what is the barriers to change? Because there is quite a few barriers like stigma that we'll talk probably about later today.
We'll talk a lot about that.
Exactly.
Too, yes.
And so we really gathered this information and then we brought it to a subject matter group. And when I talk about a group, it was advisory teams made up of 9 different teams. And it was made up of over 100 people that came in, community members, law enforcement professionals, treatment professionals, reentry, media, airline, transportation industry. I mean, it was everybody you could think about because, once again, substance misuse affects and abuse affects anybody and everybody in our system. And so we brought them together, we fed them this information, and we started to prioritize an action plan. And so I'm really proud to say that this isn't the state of Alaska's plan. This isn't even really the governor's plan. This is Alaska's plan as a whole. It's the voice of Alaska, and I think that's what's extremely powerful. I would love to say we've collected everything, and it's not missing one thing at all, but that's one of the things we've hit on. It's a living document. And so as we're moving along, for example, right now, we're starting to talk about NAS, neonatal abstinence syndrome, and how we can integrate OCS, Office of Children's Services, together, and we're creating a national project plan right now that's going to feed into this document. So it's a living document because drug trends change, substance misuse changes, and we need to make sure that we're at the forefront and we're changing with it so that we can address it immediately and not be as reactive, but I think more proactive. So... yeah.
Wow. Sounds like just kind of this great flexible framework.
I think so. It's something, it's been different. You know, I don't know if it's completely something made new, but I can tell you across the country, we're getting a lot of calls from other states going, how did you do this? How did you integrate with the community? How did you get invited in? And I think Alaska, we're a little unique in the way our processes are set up. Sometimes we don't have those counties and local public health authorities and things. We are sometimes a state, a local entity.
But there's... It shouldn't be discounted that you need to build relationships.
I agree.
You need to... I mean, it kind of goes back to what you just said earlier. Like, you went in to listen.
Yes.
And listening is so key. Elijah, you were part of that process, part of this listening and convening. I'd like to... I introduced you as a member of the National Guard, so I guess I'd like to start with why the National Guard is part of these conversations.
Absolutely. So, like you said, I'm with the Alaska National Guard, so we're state-owned. And within that program, there's the Counter-Drug Support Program. And our job is to... provide support to local coalitions or community-based organizations and kind of help increase their capacities or ensure they're kind of on the right step. Now, we cover the entire state of Alaska, and there's just me.
So hold on.
Yes.
The counter-drug support program is you.
Yes. No. So we have a team of people for civil operations that provide support to coalitions and community-based organizations. There's just me. On the other side of the house, we also provide support to local law enforcement.
Okay.
Through analysis. Yeah.
And so when you, for those who obviously aren't in the room, when you walk in, you're wearing a uniform, what effect does that have?
Well, usually I get a really positive reception from all across Alaska. Sometimes there's a little bit of confusion, which is why this is a great opportunity for me to kind of discuss that. You know, we are state-owned. I'm an Alaskan. I grew up in Fairbanks. I lived in the Mat-Su, and now I'm in Eagle River. I lived in the Mat-Su, and now I'm in Eagle River. So I'm an Alaskan living in Alaska. Most states have their own National Guards, and within those states, they also have counter-drug support programs. So those have different, you know, various options. Usually it's the law enforcement support along with the civil operations side, the support to coalitions, community-based organizations that have a drug nexus in them.
Okay.
Can I add to that too, if it's okay, Ann? You know, so I think one of the things that was really important in this process is we talked about all the multiple sectors that need to be at play. And a lot of the times we have thought about substance misuse in our approach as a law enforcement approach or a health approach. And so we really, when we went and did these community conversations, it couldn't just be like an Andy Jones in the Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention, but having the National Guard here. I mean, we have a very high population of veterans in our state who are struggling sometimes with pain management and that, but they're going to listen to somebody with a uniform. It shows a sign of respect and authority, but also we brought in, we brought in the Alaska State Troopers who traveled to every single community conversation with us. And then we had Department of Law, Corrections with us. So we actually brought a team of professionals with us. It showed that we're unified, we're trying to build a system together. So it's actually effective and efficient. And I think that really helped because it helped remove the stigma also. You know, you look at somebody in law enforcement, what do you think? Punishment. Where they really, you know, they care. They have a job to do, protect the public, but at the same time, they want to help the individual who's suffering. So I think that was a really important piece to getting the community conversations going.
And you didn't just involve people in uniforms or people with official titles with the state. You also involved a lot of community organizations. Christina, like you were also a part of this process. Tell me how you got involved with developing this action plan.
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I started working with Andy and a lot of our political leaders prior to Senate Bill 23 when we were...
What's Senate Bill 23?
Andy, do you want to explain Senate Bill 23?
Yeah, briefly.
I love it when he explains it.
Oh, yeah. So Senate Bill 23 was actually what gave us the authority to prescribe naloxone, the overdose reversal drug, to anybody and everybody. And so real quick snippet of it is the bill really highlighted, one, giving healthcare providers the ability to directly prescribe. And you're thinking, well, they could do that anyway. Pharmacists, you could go to a pharmacy. The problem is this stuff's expensive. So the other piece of that was really important that it said is, an organization, state government, that has a, well, an individual or a volunteer, an employee of a overdose response program that receives a training can directly administer or distribute this drug. And so that's actually the emphasis of declaring a disaster because of the statewide medical standing orders, getting life-saving medications in the hands of individuals as we work to build a treatment program. And so Senate Bill 23 was extremely powerful, giving us those authorities. And just a real quick before I'll end here, but one of the outcomes of Ben is currently today, we have actually seen potentially, if the year ends well, a 48% decrease in overdose deaths from 2017 to 2018. That's humongous. When you look at the country, I don't know of many other states that are seeing a 48% decrease. And I think it's not just the overdose reversal drug. I think mm-hmm. it's education, the work that Christina does for mm-hmm. her advocacy and recovery and all of this.
Christina, tell us a little bit more about that work that you're doing.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm having kind of a moment. I didn't...
You didn't realize it was 48%?
That's like, huge.
Yeah, it's...
It's really huge.
It's a lot of lives. It's a lot of lives saved and a lot of community members brought back.
Yeah. Yeah. So this was really, I mean, it was really, really exciting in the beginning to recognize that we had people in leadership that were not only tolerating people with lived experience, but celebrating them and also asking them to lead. You know, we've talked a lot about those closest to the problem or closest to the solution, but furthest away from resources and power. And that's a quote from Glenn Martin. But I think that it really talks about what we're dealing with here, you know, really listening to people who are on the ground. And so coming into this was really always about listening to people who were living it day in and day out and celebrating people who are on the ground and really moving this momentum forward, you know, in a really like authentic and genuine way. And so Senate Bill 23 was the first like tangible actions that individuals could have that we would see like lives saved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when it was signed, it felt like such an enormous moment to say like these lives matter and we're going to put this into action that reflects what we're saying. And so that was really incredible. And then that turned into the opioid task force, you know, which was the beginning of, for me, really seeing all of these different partners come together, not having just an individual response, a community response, and then also a systems response. I'd never seen so many different political leaders coming together, so many different commissioners coming together to the summit advisory team and having, you know, this luxury, you know, this time to really think about, well, what's happening and what could our response be?
And Christina, as a person who's in long-term recovery, what do you think are the messages that you really wanted leaders to hear that you weren't sure that they had heard in the past?
For me, it's always been about, you know, what we talked about this. So we're talking about an opioid epidemic, but we're recognizing that addiction has been an epidemic in our state for a really long time. And for me, it's always been about making that, connecting those dots between pain and addiction. For my individual experience with addiction has always been trauma, that was the causation and correlation that led into my addiction. And so on a higher level, thinking about what trauma has our community experienced, what trauma has the land experience. And so then we open the door to start talking about cultural, generational, historical trauma and how that has led into. And for me, it feels like the most important thing to liberate people. And one of the most pivotal moments of my entire life was I was in addiction. I was homeless for many years. And as an Alaska Native woman, really having this moment to say, I am who people say I am. You know, that we recognize that there are all these societal narratives that exist and how those become our core beliefs about who we are. For instance, like what do people say about people who are in addiction? Mm-hmm. They say that they're lazy. They say that they're stupid. They say that they should be, some people say that they should die. You know, a lot of people say that they should be locked up and removed from the public. What do people say about Alaska Native people? You know, and these aren't things that I was taught. These were things that I caught, you know. So as an Alaska Native person who was struggling with addiction, who was also homeless, you know, the oppression and thinking about all of the trauma that I'd survived. And this was just, this was a way of coping. And so Dr. Paul Finch, he's a physician's assistant. Paul Finch was the first person that ever told me, Christina, you're not a bad person. You're a sick person. And that there is a way out, that your life matters. And I think that, you know, through all of this, that's what we're saying again and again and again and again, is that people's lives matter, you know, regardless of whatever the societal narrative is, that we believe that these lives matter. And further, no, we have evidence and we have science that supports that the pain that they've gone through has led them to this place of addiction, of pain.
It's amazing how many times I've heard refrains of that story, like little bits of the time that someone told me that it's not that I have experienced trauma, that I'm sick, that I'm not a bad person. And that comes up so often in narratives about reaching recovery. And I'd like to invite listeners into this conversation. What have you heard? What are the stories that are being told in your community around issues of addiction? Share those stories by calling us at 1-800-478-8255 or here in Anchorage, 550-8422. On Talk of Alaska, we're talking about the statewide opioid action plan and ways that we can help our communities recover from trauma. And Christina, you brought up all these things about how communities were talking about deeper issues. It's more than just, we're just looking at opioids. And Elijah, I'd love to hear from you. What were some of the themes that you heard over these conversations across the state?
Yeah, so, you know, first off, going around the state and hearing from everyone was so amazing and so powerful to see all the great things that were happening. So many stories like Christina's over and over again is just so powerful and speaks to why this is so important, you know? What we heard a lot kind of is reflected in the plan, right? We talked a lot about stigma already, but that's goal one. And the reason is because, you know, everywhere we would go, that is what we would hear. We'd hear that's, you know, this is the big issue that we're facing. And it kind of shows that with the stigma, people kind of lose hope and it prevents them from seeking help and taking that next step. And if we're as a community, if we're continually stigmatizing people and preventing them from seeking help, then we're not actually fixing any problems. We're just pushing that further down and continuing this process. And anybody new who comes into addiction, they're gonna be faced with those same issues. So the, you know, stigma is not the solution to fixing this problem. It's ending stigma and coming together as a community. That's what's gonna provide solutions.
And what are ways to do that? What are ways to change this narrative around addiction? And I'd love to hear solutions from all of you.
I'd be more than happy to start there. Because that was one of the first themes, you know, that Dr. Butler and myself actually did. We traveled around the state. It wasn't just community conversations. It was town halls. I mean, I traveled to more communities than I ever have in my life, but it was at the request of the community. So really talking about that addiction is not a moral failing, you know, it's a health condition, you know, and I think Christina hit it very well. There's those social, biological, environmental factors that may drive somebody to using, right? Poverty, you know, there's so many factors that could lead to addiction. So educating the community on this. Now, some of the tactics that we have taken, I want to step back a little bit. When we talk about stigma, there's two stigma battles that we have right now. Stigma with use, but I think I've actually seen that tide starting to turn in Alaska. But there's also stigma related to treatment. Mm-hmm. Many people have their opinions on the best pathway to treatment, you know, so it may be abstinence-based, it may be medical-based. And I think what we need, that's the new battle that we're working on, is I think we got to realize not one pathway works for everybody. We have to have multiple pathways, multiple options. Giving people the options that works, you know, for example, Vivitrol or Naltrexone only works on certain people who have, you know, certain conditions in place in that. And if it doesn't work and we don't have for other platforms, then what are we doing for that individual? We're not serving them the justice. We're not giving them the tools they need. But coming back on how do we address stigma, some of the tactics that we took right off the bat was filming individuals, talking about hope, the challenges. And so I was very proud that our state medical examiner, Dr. Gary Zintek, he was one of the first who actually talked about his addiction, losing his medical license, losing his family technically, you know. And so that tactic, what I really was looking at is we're taking a high-level official in government in the state of Alaska, our only state medical examiner, and highlighting that this individual, can be affected by this. It, you know, a lot of times we think it's one race, it's one group, and this this affects anybody and everybody. Mm-hmm. Mayor Matherly told his story. And so we told stories that were sad, but came out with hope. And we started continuing to tell stories of hope. You know, Christina, Kara Nelson, Taria Walters, you know, Mark Weaver, you name it, telling their stories. I think that's really important because you're getting a face. You're looking at somebody who's doing great things in their community, and that starts to change. The other tactic that we took is when you talk about addiction, you'll hear people say, we need to meet the individual where they're at. The same concept works with a community. When we're talking about addiction and we're educating, we need to meet the community. And so we started working with Golden View area in South Anchorage, and the PTA there actually hosted their own community conversation, community cafe event. It was way cool. The first time I went and presented, three or four people came, was it. I was so depressed. But one of the things we realized is the word opioids or heroin, actually the word heroin scares a lot of people, not in my backyard. But when we started talking about prescription medications, sometimes, you know, it relates a little bit closer. So we started saying, well, maybe naloxone isn't the right tool for this PTA at this point. But maybe it's drug disposal bags and safe disposal of our medications. And boy, those parents went crazy. And the next thing I knew, a couple months later, we had, I think, over 70 people. Mm-hmm. The Muni of Anchorage, the mayor came. And this was a community within Anchorage that hosted this. And that was really powerful. So I think we have to remember, meet the community where they're at, start the conversation there, and then start not, you know, I think it's a shared process of education because we learn so much. You know, Christina, for example, she is way more knowledgeable than I am in this, you know, but together I think we're really powerful as one, you know, we can only do so much. So that's been some of my tactics.
And Elijah, I saw you nodding as well. Like, what are...
Absolutely. So, you know, kind of goal two is the coordination of things, right? And what Andy was talking about, where you have those stigmas between different items of recovery, I think it's really important that we all kind of get together and that acknowledge that everyone's recovery can look a little bit different and support that. And if you're an organization that focuses in one area, if you can't meet that person's needs, being able to do a warm handoff to somebody else who can meet their needs better, and that individual can create their kind of support systems to help support that recovery, I think that'd be really important. And just communicating everything that we've been working on. Like Andy was saying, the drug disposal bags, you know, that's kind of a great place to start the conversation. I was working with the municipality of Anchorage. We did the community cafe. One of the things that we started doing was trying to get drug disposal bags into each of the pharmacies around Anchorage. We've been pretty successful at this. So if you go to most pharmacies in Anchorage, you'll be able to get up a drug disposal bag.
And what is a drug disposal bag? Like, why would you use one of those as opposed to just tossing the drugs in your trash can?
So if you just toss the drugs in the trash can, a couple of things can happen. So with the medication, you know, it could be abused potentially. It could be taken by somebody who shouldn't necessarily have it. And it can also be dangerous if you have, you know, kids in the house or even somebody who's just unsuspecting. You can use that and, it could be potentially fatal, right? So you want to kind of remove that from your environment. These drug disposal bags is a great way. Just activated charcoal inside the bag. You pour the pills in, the liquid or the patches. Each bag will tell you how many you can put in there. And it's basically renders the drug useless and you can just throw it away in the garbage can. So it's a really great way. It's a great conversation starter. And one of the things that we've kind of seen too is that most people are unaware of this. You know, so like I was saying, we got them around most pharmacies. I was getting coffee at a coffee shop. I was in uniform, like, well, what are you doing off base? And I was like, well, this is what I'm doing. I'm kind of just distributing these drug disposal bags. And, they had this conversation. I was like, well, and they told me, well, I get these medications from my dentist, and I'm just going to hang on to them because that makes more sense to me. And I was like, that's exactly the conversation that we're having. That medication that you're getting, these are opioids, these painkillers are opioids, and that's, you know, really what you're looking for. So I still think that there is some work to be done.
Definitely.
For, you know, acknowledging what's going on and what we're actually talking about. And I think that's, you know, kind of the first steps to reducing that stigma.
It also kind of helps not becoming a victim of crime, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, when you're heavily addicted, it changes the way you think. You do things you never would have thought you would have done, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, when you start to go through withdrawal, you know, because maybe you don't have the drug or the prescription medication, it's horrific. I mean, if you've ever seen somebody who goes through it, it's the worst thing to see. And that, you know, I've heard things like, my skin feels like it's falling off. So people do anything to get that drug. So one, people just get them out of their house. They shouldn't be holding on to these pills. We're Alaskans. We like to prepare. I get it. The other thing is the days of when I was in high school, it was more like kegerators, right? You know, and mm-hmm. after school parties. Nowadays, kids have pill parties. And so medications can be diverted easy. Kids are smart. And so parents, we should be protecting our youth, getting rid of those medications in our cabinet. And so instead of, you know, giving some money for the purchase of that keg back in the day, you know, it's, you know, your entry into the party a lot of times is you provide these pills. And who knows, you could have a benzo and an opioid and there's the end. And so we really need to be that education, but also that preventative measure of disposing is really, really important. Mm-hmm. It also gives rural Alaska a tool. Because drug take-back days doesn't work in every community across the state. So this tool is great because it allows our rural small communities to be able to destroy their medications safely, and it won't harm our environment so mm-hmm. that they can continue their subsistence activities without, you know, having probably fish with high, you know, rates of medication in it or something like that.
I would like to go to the phone lines now. We have Paul from Anchorage on the line. Paul, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the program.
Yes, a part of what I was wondering about is breaking the cycle or the generational problem of addiction by counseling specifically for the children of addicts mm-hmm. about what that experience was like as a child and intervening so that you have specific tools for dealing with that sort of the terrible role model and the way it's seen as a way to address stress or challenges in life is to, you know, follow this addiction and the trauma of it producing the grounds for addiction among children mm-hmm. of these addicts. And I've always wondered what kinds of programs the state of Alaska has for that, so that you're ahead of the curve on the problem of addiction. And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul, very much.
I could kind of start, and then maybe Christina or, you know, Elijah wants to start. I think the big thing with that question is we call that upstream prevention, where we're trying to address things early on in a child's life, right? The adverse childhood experience. One of the challenges, it's been something that we've highlighted in the plan that we need children psychologists, things like that, the counseling. Workforce development's a big issue in our state, you know, and so really working to bring more of that workforce development up here is a big challenge that we're working on, you know, mm-hmm. looking at maybe some of the programs we have in place in the state to help bring providers up.
He was asking about helping children of people mm-hmm. who have addictions, and you're talking workforce development.
Well, because you have to have, like, so a child who, let's say, they need that maybe counseling service, you know, you have to have the workforce in place to be able to provide that service to the child. And so I think that's one of the barriers that we're working on, is trying to bring more of that infrastructure in place. Some of the things we're looking at with a child, you know, right now is more of those after-school activities that we can help with, you know. But I think a combination of getting more child psychologists up here who can help with the counseling is going to be critical for us.
Therapists.
It's definitely a gap in our system. And so, like I said, we're looking at, you know, what are maybe some programs that we could intrigue some of these therapists or clinicians to come up here. And so that's something we're talking right now with behavioral health.
Christina, what are your thoughts?
Oh, this is such a great question. Thank you so much for the question. And I want to honor that this question probably is so deep for individuals, you know, that have experience, that have, you know, that come from families that struggle with addiction. What we know about addiction is that it is a family disease, and, you know, that it often affects three or more generations, but that could be endless if there isn't some type of intervention. So the big question is, how do we break the cycle? And that early upstream prevention, we recognize that the number one thing that we could do is prevent early onset. And so that we recognize that trauma is a factor, and when we have households where addiction is present, then that's incredibly traumatic for children. And then they also learn that as a coping mechanism. And so I think that, you know, that dives into cultural solutions as well as community solutions. And so having counselors or psychologists is one pathway, but also celebrating communities already have those solutions. You know, there are a lot of, like, where I'm from, and a lot of the villages that I travel to, they don't have psychologists and they don't have counselors. But I honestly believe, and I've seen solutions within those communities, communities coming together. And so what we often say is that, like Andy said, that isolation fuels addiction. The opposite of addiction is connection. The opposite of addiction is relationship. And the opposite of addiction is community. So, you know, really, I think bringing to light, you know, that giving people permission to talk about this, giving people permission to say that addiction is present in my family and not being ashamed about it is enormous. And then saying, you know what, I don't have the coping skills to deal with whatever this problem is. Because the point is that people do the very best they can until they learn another way. So to break the cycle, we really have to humanize the problem, to say that we recognize that people are in pain here and they don't know how to deal with the issues that they have at hand. And so then giving them as many options as possible and recognizing that, like Andy said, there are a lot of different pathways. There are so many, as many different ways as people come into addiction, there are just as many ways to come out of it, to break that cycle.
Mm-hmm. We are going to take a quick break here on Talk of Alaska, and then we'll be back with more of your calls, talking about addiction and recovery and the statewide plan for healing.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Remera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska reminds residents that open enrollment is now. KFF studies indicate the average 2017 tax credit for eligible Alaskans was over $700 a month. Enroll at Remera.com. This message sponsored by Remera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about addiction around the state and ways to prevent it and to treat it. We're talking about the statewide opioid plan. If you'd like to join this conversation, please give us a call at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. Here in Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8422. And we're going to go ahead and go back to the phone lines. We have Connor from Homer on the line. Connor, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me. So my name is Connor Schmidt. Elijah, we actually met. You came and saw our curriculum at Marathon. So I represent the rec room down in Homer, and we put together a whole substance misuse.
What is the rec room?
The rec room is a teen youth resource center down here in Homer. We're actually affiliated with the Catchmac Bay Family Planning Clinic.
Okay.
The safe space that teens can come and hang out with, and we help support resilience in them, and also teaching reproductive health. And then some of the misuse kind of came out of that, as that's a big risk factor for teen unintended pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And so through that, we found that wanting to kind of focus on what middle schoolers' experiences are around this, because we think that that's a big portion of where they're experiencing this. And a big part of our lessons is asking these students what their experience around drugs and alcohol is as middle schoolers. And a lot of that reflects on kind of their parents' usage and the messages that their parents are receiving around this. And so one thing that we've kind of struggled with is, how do we as facilitators and as educators address that, yeah, your parents have the choice to use, but what do you students and middle schoolers do in those situations where they're really uncomfortable with parental usage? And if they're seeing it at home and they see their parents building unhealthy relationships around substances, then how do we encourage them to change that, or to, you know, I think as Christina said before, around changing or breaking the cycle of use. So I don't know if you have any feedback about that, but thanks for having me on.
Do you guys mind if I answer this?
Yeah,
no, please do.
Oh my gosh, this is such a brilliant question. Okay, so we're talking about framing addiction. And what's the best way to frame this for adolescent minds? So the Addiction Foreign Policy has a really brilliant video. It's like 4 minutes long, but it talks about this. It talks about the disease of addiction. And it really makes it so comprehensive that people understand that it's a disease of choice. And so some people use substances and how they're, like any disease, there are different stages, there are different progressions. And so that really dives into starting to see addiction less as a moral failing and more as a chronic medical condition, life-threatening medical condition that hijacks your brain. That, you know, and this is, I mean, like, this is the greatest question maybe of our time, because to answer this question, then we're in conflict with, like, philosophical things like Plato and Socrates, that, you know, that really starts to dive in that, you know, the morality of things, so that this is a medical condition that really makes people think very differently about behavior. And I think that that's probably the toughest question for people to understand. But as providers, as trainers, and this is probably the biggest question in the medical community. We get the most pushback from the medical community. Is addiction a disease? And, you know, if we really want the solutions, we have to understand the problem. And, you know, when we are coming at it from it, there's a lot of brilliant research out there that supports that addiction is a disease. Well, and if we do believe it's a disease, then we need to speak about it from that perspective. And I think that's really, really liberating for children if they understand that their parents aren't bad, that they have a medical condition, and that there are options. They don't have to die that way, you know. And then they start to get education that it can be generational, you know. That if you have a loved one that struggled with addiction, you know, that's something that they could. But offering the hope, you know, the best part about adverse childhood experiences or adverse community experiences or individual experiences is the resiliency of that. So these are the things. And if this has happened within your family, if this is happening in your community, these are the possibilities. But it's not destiny. It's not destiny. And these are all of the different options to come out of it and how it can be turned around into a really beautiful thing, as well as providing those stories. Like I have a horrific story of trauma, you know, that is difficult to tell. I wouldn't change any of it, and it's coming at it from that completely different perspective, and again, humanizing the problem.
I want to jump back to something that you said at the beginning of this. You said it's a disease of choice. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah. So as the progression starts, it starts in the frontal part of the brain, logic, reasoning. And as it moves through, it affects the five areas of the brain, all the way down into the brainstem, our primitive part of our brain. And in our brainstem, that's where we breathe, that's where we eat, that's where we find shelter, we protect our children. And so when that area is compromised, I used to tell people that if I could have traded drugs for oxygen, then I would have. And now I have the science that really supports that. And it starts to make sense when we look at these brain imaging scans and we see how it affects that area and how people will choose lack of choice, right? That's mm-hmm. That's a funny way to say it. How we see the consequences, where it appears as though someone chose drugs over their children, where it appears as though someone chose drugs over their family or over their work or over their life. People lose their lives. Mm-hmm. They lose their teeth. They lose their health. They lose their wealth. We look at them, and it's the only medical condition that I know of that, you know, is apparent on someone's face, but we don't feel bad for them. You know, we have some morality, some visceral response to what we're seeing. And I think that it's one of the most important elements in education for people to understand.
So this conversation leads directly to a comment that we just received from Jim and Wasilla over email. And he said, your discussion is getting close, but what about parenting? Most people who are old enough to get addicted are also old enough to make babies. He said, I'm old enough to observe the beginning of the drug culture of the 60s, and I chose not to give up my free agency for group drug use. But I think his major point is like how do you have conversations with people who are entering into addiction around parenting choices? How do you make them aware of that?
Can I actually? So I just want to go back first to the last question, just mm-hmm. so I can round off on that one. One of the things is you know, asked, how do you talk to youth sometimes in the middle, you know, the middle school age? And so our office in at the state, we may not be the experts all the time, but we're the connectors because we've built this big network. And so the one thing I could say to that individual in Homer, and I forgot your name already, I apologize.
Connor.
But, hey, all right, perfect, Connor, is my house in the Matsu Valley, Michelle Overstreet and Mike Carson. They do phenomenal work with all ages of youth, and I would recommend reaching out to them. Connor, if you don't have their contact, maybe there's a way we can get your information. And then Mike Carson and them, I would really reach out to them because they've been doing some amazing work with middle-aged youth and how they can talk and work with their parents. So I think that's an important piece. Now, the question of working with individuals who may be heavily in addiction, about parenting and the lifestyle skill, you know, choices. Unfortunately, sometimes there's this intersection of our Office of Children's Services. And so I think what we need, what we've been working heavily on, as I was speaking earlier, is we're continuing to educate the Office of Children's Services more and more on the substance misuse problems, the different pathways to recovery. And so they're a great avenue to connect with that individual. And I think that's what we're always looking for. Who's the best connector sometimes? Mm-hmm. And even though it can be very contentious, sometimes that's a great way. The other person that I think is really good who can help us with these discussions is an individual like Christina, who's in recovery, or Carl Soderstrom. People who have that lived experience are going to be able to connect better with that individual who can discuss these type of topics at hand. Where if I come in, they're going to say, "Who are you, Andy Jones? You have, you don't know how to relate to me or something." And so, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a big piece.
Well, and I think that this goes back to developing the workforce. And so I would say that the best person to answer this question is a parent who used throughout pregnancy and continue to use in the early stages of life for their children, and the amount of shame that they feel, and you know, and how they came out of that, and how they're parenting now, and having them speak to parents, you know, who are in addiction, who are maybe making the choice to have children. We've had a couple of brilliant doctors come up and really talk about how this affects people at every culture, every level of society. You know, I think that when I initially say, what do you think about women who are pregnant and who are using drugs and drinking, a lot of people's minds will go to people in poverty. But that is not necessarily true. When we look at the numbers for FAS, specifically here in the state of Alaska, this is not a cultural issue or just a poverty issue. And so I think that, again, every question is going to touch on stigma and our perception of society and where the problem really lies. But this question is for parents, you know, across the board. And in thinking about, we know that the amount of children that have FAS, you know, if you're not
spectrum disorder.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Right. Stay away from the acronyms. And so I think that that we need to have people in these positions that, you know, that we're really valuing their lived experience to speak into people who are experiencing that.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to add on to that, I think the important piece, like Christina said there, is that lived experience. And so one of the things we've been looking at is, you know, I know it's hard to say we're going to form another task force or work group, but as we're really addressing these topics at hand, you know, if it's the parenting aspect and substance misuse, we've got some big champions in our state who have lost their children, who currently still have their children, are trying to reconnect. And so, like Christina said, I think it's gaining the knowledge from them, and as we continue to build our infrastructure and the services we need, it's not about me, Elijah, or even maybe Christina, but it's that work group who's going to really help us mm-hmm. to really build, I think, information that makes sense that will really help the population that's suffering. So that's one of our tasks at hand, and a lot of
work. Yeah. Well, I think it's also uncovering the stories that we haven't told yet. So I really want to do a shout out to one of my sponsees. Yesterday she called me and she was really proud, and she said, I had a conversation with my son's teacher, and it was about how he's acting out in school and how he can't sit still. And she said, well, I want you to know that I used drugs when I was pregnant with him. And for the early stages of his life, I continued to use drugs. And she said, Christine, I refuse to be ashamed of it. That was something then, and I'm doing much better now. And it's about delivering that information connection and creating a space where people can tell those stories, and then also working with the people who receive those stories. You know, our medical providers, our teachers. You know, we have it's a culture change. It's a complete shift. You know, so that the opposite of stigma is acceptance, and it doesn't mean that we aren't going to work to address the problem. It doesn't mean that we're going to ignore it or that we're going to be passive about it. But it does speak to being able to talk about it in a way that we've never talked about it before.
We are going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more of your calls on Talk of Alaska and more conversation.
Funding for Talk of Alaska was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska reminds residents that open enrollment is now through December 15th. CMS studies indicate 90% of Alaskans qualified for a tax credit in 2017. Enroll at Premera.com. This message sponsored by Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska.
And we are back with more Talk of Alaska. You can reach us at 1-800-478-8255. I'd like to go to the phone lines now. We have Jean in Anchorage on the line. Jean, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. My concern is that once you have identified the problem, there's very, very little treatment available, at least in Anchorage. We had to send our daughter outside to get inpatient help for her heroin addiction. So what's Alaska going to do in-state for recovering addicts?
Andy.
Yeah, that's a great question, Jean, and I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head there. Is we don't have enough services. You know, when you look at the continuum of care or the cycle that we go through, we have things like detox treatment. Not everyone has to go through detox, but there's very little treatment here in the state, mainly focused around, I think, maybe, you know, the Anchorage Bowl area. And then you have inpatient or, you know, residential treatment where somebody will be, you know, within a facility, or outpatient treatment sometimes too. Now, outpatient treatments become more and more popular. And so one of the things that we've been working on is we are educating our healthcare community and our doctors so they can get their waiver forms to where they can actually prescribe this medication. Now, when you look at MAT, medication-assisted treatment, we got to remember what we're talking about right now is just the medication aspect. Probably one of the most also equally important aspects is the assisted treatment or therapy aspect. And so really that counseling and the ongoing. So if you don't combine the two together, the rate of success is very minimal. So we have, we've put quite a bit of federal grant money. Since I started this response in 2017, we've secured over $36 million that we're inflexing into the community to beef up treatment and recovery services. Now, I just want to highlight, we got to build this system appropriately. So as we're putting detox in place, we also need to be looking at the back end and recovery support services and housing and what it takes to reenter into the community. And so we've had services, you know, coming more and more online. But one of those gaps we have, like I was talking about earlier, is the workforce development, having the people who are here to provide the services. We have just received a waiver from, that's the 1115 waiver. It's going to allow us to increase our bed capability in the state. That's exciting. So it is, you know, I think since the response, we've increased 300 beds treatment-wise, but it's still not enough. Now, the one thing I want to say that as we've traveled around the state and I've been looking at the cycle of treatment, I've noticed that, for example, when I was in Dillingham and we were at the treatment facility there in the recovery residence, a lot of the residents there were actually not from Dillingham. So a lot of the time, what we found out is somebody who goes into treatment, Christina, you can back me up here, or maybe I'm wrong, but what I've noticed is the trend is a lot of times, sometimes you need to get out of your community because you have these social, you have the environmental factors, these triggers that if you go right back in, it's going to trigger you potentially to using again. And so by going out of your community, getting healthy, learning how to reintegrate with life and community again and becoming a productive and healthy member, and then coming back to your community, you have much more of a success rate. That might not be the case for everybody, but it seems to be one of the methods. But we are working diligently. I can say in this administration, their priority we hear is public safety. And when you think of public safety and you think of the sphere of public safety, we think of lock them up. But what the governor's really highlighted is it is an enforcement approach, but it's also a treatment approach. And so we are looking at how can we maximize all the funding that we have in the state, federal grant-wise, and general fund-wise to really beef up that capability. So it is going to take a lot of work on the communities' part and the state's part.
And what's really holding state agencies accountable? Like, you have this great plan. It's really interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
Like, how do we know that you're actually going to implement this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what we've done is we set up, like, an incident command structure. Not like, we did. And so when we had the earthquake response that just occurred a couple of weeks ago, there was an incident command. And in that incident command structure, you have an incident commander, and you have a deputy, and you have this big structure. And so we've been doing this for 2 years. And I think, yes, we still have a lot of work ahead of us, but what happens is I have a cycle where every 2 weeks I meet with the boots on the ground workers in state government from all different departments. It's made up of over 100 people. They report through these different sub-task forces we have or teams to me, and then I brief this up to the cabinet members. If we're having gaps somewhere, then I go to the cabinet member and say, hey, I need some help here. And since this is the governor's priority and we have these meetings, it really helps to direct the focus on the commissioners, right? Because this is their priority too. And so I think we all realize this is a unified front and an effort. And so so we've really had no problems whatsoever. I mean, and I think it's about partnerships. If you come in and you take that dictator approach, no one wants to work with you. But if you take the approach of, this isn't my money in the Department of Health, and I work in the Department of Health and Social Services. I have a mission that's broader, right? It's the entire state. And so my money in the Department of Health really can go to, maybe some of it goes to the troopers, right? And maybe some of it goes to corrections because they're furthering our mission. They just may needed the financial support to, let's say, provide treatment behind the walls or get naloxone in the hands of all law enforcement officials across the state. And so I think the accountability is the consistency in our meetings every 2 weeks, even though they get a little exhausting by, I think, the members, and then the priority up above. So we have a down, you know, a top approach and a down approach. And so it's worked quite well so far. And I'm hoping that'll continue to work.
Okay. Another thing, in addition to this being such a cross-sectional approach, another thing that really jumped out at me when reading this report was talking about the causes of addiction. And it straight up says that racism is one of the things that can lead to addiction to various substances. And I was wondering if any of you guys could, or Christina, or any of you could really highlight that and kind of talk a little bit more about why that's included and what that means.
Yeah, it's enormous. And so that we know that when people feel apart from, you know, and when there are actions of other individuals that are harmful, any type of harm leads to addiction. And I think that this starts to develop into the conversation of intersectionality, that you cannot separate addiction from poverty, from homelessness, from incarceration, from mental health, from domestic violence, from sexual assault. So it's not one, you can't, there's no way of tearing it apart. And so when we look at, and it also gives us this beautiful conversation about community, you know, and I think that this, in some aspect, like this goes back to Jean's question about her daughter and how her daughter had to leave. And so it's wonderful when, let's say that we have access to treatment, that anybody could go to any treatment center that they wanted in anywhere in America. The point is that when they return, that community has to be ready to receive them. So we have to look at all of those elements within the community that make it possible for people to succeed, and that we recognize that historical trauma, generational trauma, and in this specific, that racism and that elements are of our community are what lead people into addiction. That is an adverse experience, that when people experience racism, that causes harm and that ripples out and affects them.
Could I add just a little bit there? Because I think, you know, maybe not on, you know, great points there, Christina. And the one part about reentry and into the community, you know, when we talk about solutions on what, you know, we look at, there's no way we could put treatment facilities and capacity in every community. But when I look across the board, one of the things I think we can do in every community is we can create a recovery residence, recovery housing. Yes, infrastructure's, you know, it's harder and harder the farther you get out in rural Alaska. But if you have an environment that's run by peers, it doesn't have to have all these medical professionals. I've seen things, like I said, Fiend to Clean in the Valley. What they've done, Carl and his group, is they've rented houses out and they've got great success rates with what they're doing out there. And so it's a lot about being able to come back home, you know. And one of the challenges we deal with in Alaska, I mean, I grew up in a small town, is everybody knows who you are, what your business is. And so you have this stigma put on yourself like, oh man, should I go back home? Those social factors that are put in place. But I think, you know, like some of our communities like Togiak, who are working very hard on the law enforcement side, but they also want the recovery resident side. So I'm really encouraged to see, you know, that model built. And when we talk about a model, I don't want to take a national model and say, this is what needs to go in there. Because I think we need to integrate the tribal, the historical values. I mean, you know, healing homes. I've learned a lot from like the organized village of Cake. And so we need to blend these approaches together. And I think that's something that we can do across the state that could be extremely successful for the individuals entering recovery.
Yeah, I want to say one more thing about this. And so for people, what I hear a lot of people say is that racism doesn't exist. And so what would that be doing in the plan? When we look on a system level, then we know that Alaska Natives and people, that minorities are being disproportionately represented in our criminal justice system. That for the exact same crime that an Alaska Native man would receive more time than somebody who identifies with the dominant culture. We know that 70% of Alaska Native children who enter into OCS care are never returned. And that's specifically based on race. And so when we start to look at those systems and how that affects people, if you're incarcerated, if you've lost your children, you know, what's the likelihood of you coming out of addiction? What's the likelihood of you coming in to recover? That we recognize that there are more barriers for people that are not part of the dominant culture.
Not to ask you an impossible question, but are there things that you've seen that have effectively started to change that situation?
I think that the conversation, you know, when I stand into, I will never forget, it affects me on an individual level. This is not an us and them thing. And this is like, my freedom is bound up in yours. When there's this woman from Utqiagvik, and she said, Christina, she said, I still feel like the stupid village girl. You know, when we're surrounded in this room, and that deeply applies to me. You know, when I look around and I don't see other Alaska Native women, other Alaska Native people, other minority groups represented in different levels of our system, you know, then I think, what am I doing here? Who am I to be here? And so I think that it's having those conversations. When I ask that question, when we start to talk about oppression, what does society say about women? Mm-hmm. What does society say about Alaska Native people? What does society say about addiction? You know, then we start to think that, like, there's all of these conversations that are in between the lines. When we start to address those, then we get to liberate all of us. Like, my body is okay to look however it is. It is okay that I came from a house that didn't have a lot of money. Like, I was ashamed that I was poor for a long time. Like, all of these things, I was ashamed that I was Alaska Native. I was ashamed that I struggled with addiction. They're so bound up together, I think that that was one of the most freeing conversations that I could ever have, to say, like, it's the permission to be human and giving other people that permission. You know, then we start to see chains fall off. You know, then people all of a sudden, you know, then you don't feel like you're too broken or too bad. And you see other people who have found a way to live in this world and be free. And that, I mean, I've seen it individually, and I know that because we're having this conversation right now, we could have never had this conversation 10 years ago.
I think that is the perfect note to start closing the program on. You've been listening to Talk of Alaska. My guests today were Christina Love, a person in long-term recovery, joining us from the KTOO studios in Juneau. We have Andy Jones, Director of Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention, and Elijah Gutierrez with the Alaska National Guard Counter-Drug Support Program. Thank you all very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.